Texas Monthly. From Texas Monthly, this is State of Mind. I'm your host, Katie Vine. Each week on this podcast, you'll hear stories and meet characters that bring this state to life. This week, Life in Dog Years by Mimi Swartz. Starting with her first Texas Monthly byline in the magazine's fifth issue back in 1973, Mimi has documented major changes in Texas culture, especially healthcare, politics, and the news around Houston. She's won national magazine awards for her work on women's reproductive rights and tort reform, and she's written books on two epic Houston stories, The Collapse of Enron and The Quest to Invent the Artificial Heart. But you're about to hear a different kind of story from Mimi, a personal one about love and loss and cherishing the time you're given with your family, two-legged and four-legged alike. Here's Mimi Swartz with Life in Dog Years.
A couple of years ago, my middle-aged cousins hosted a family reunion because we were all tired of meeting at funerals. One of the scheduled events was a slideshow of all the Swartz family pets. Although all of the family's human descendants had turned out fine, dysfunctional pet rearing has been pretty consistent throughout the generations. The demonstration included dogs snarling, dogs with oozing hot spots, dogs with weight issues, and dogs with many missing teeth. My grandmother's stinky poodle, whose soiled tennis shoe aroma most of us could still conjure, and my cousin Alan's spoiled mutt. Doling out table scraps was a way of life. So was sharing pillows with drooling canines. Supposedly, my uncle's last words were, "Get this damn dog off my bed." My father inherited the family predisposition for bad pet parenting. Before I was born, my parents had a black cat that liked to sit atop the toilet tank, wait for unsuspecting male guests to get started, and then take a swipe. There was a basset hound named Janet who suffered from persistent mange and whose skin had to be scrubbed daily with a stinky solution on a toothbrush. We had a Great Dane, Choppa, who once left a Stephen King-like scene in a hallway after wagging his scabby tail against a wall and sending blood spewing everywhere. We also had several generations of semi-feral cats, which caused our fancy Siamese to abandon us for a fancy restaurant nearby. We had reunions on holidays. After my brothers and I left home, the pet population declined. But just like empty nesters who crave grandchildren, my mother and father started longing for a dog after they sold our house and moved to a high-rise condo. Mom had the idea that raising a puppy was something she and my father could do together in their golden years. She got on the web and began searching for the most compatible breed. What I suspect is that she wanted a nice-looking, smart, somewhat eccentric dog, kind of like my parents. Mom eventually settled on a Welsh Corgi. The American Kennel Club website describes the breed as smart and affectionate, among the most agreeable of all small house dogs, and a lively little herder who is companionable without being needy. I'm not sure that my mother ever realized that what she had found was, for Dad, the perfect second wife. My parents ended up with a male puppy, which they named Wesley, after, I assumed, some long-lost aristocratic relative we never had. He was adorable. He had reddish orange and white markings, no tail, and longer legs, by corgi standards, that gave him a jaunty step. Corgis, originally bred for rounding up cattle, are famous for their herding abilities, but in modern times have also been known to steer humans to their proper places, especially when they don't know where to turn. And like so many before him, Wesley immediately affixed himself to my father with a fierce, undying loyalty. With the rest of us, Wesley could barely be bothered. I began to wonder whether the Queen of England had so many corgis because she was trying to find one that would give her the time of day. In defeat, my mother began saying that when she died, she wanted to come back as Wesley. I could see why. Wesley had customized doggy steps leading up to my parents' bed. His personalized leather collar was from Ralph Lauren. He traveled widely. In New York, he networked with the dogs of Wall Street traders. In Santa Fe, he hobnobbed with the gallerists of Canyon Road. At home, Dad and Wesley took long walks and sunned themselves in the small park beside my parents' high rise. Dad confided to me, "You know, when Wesley dies, I'd like to donate a water fountain in his name." In the car, Wesley sat in Dad's lap. Their companionship was constant. Wesley had his own water bowls at most neighborhood restaurants, where the waitstaff greeted him warmly and he pretended to care. As time passed, I became too busy with my own life to notice that Wesley, like my parents, was aging. But my mother was keenly aware. She had begun to worry about Dad's reaction to Wesley's inevitable death. He was 12, old in corgi years. Searching the web for a suitable replacement, Mom found a kennel near Dallas with a 5-year-old show dog named Trilby and began planning a meetup. She thought that maybe, just maybe, this dog could be shared. But that was not to be. On a blazing August morning in 2009, Dad was on a rare trip to California, and Mom, who was 78 and fragile, decided to take Wesley for a walk. She either fell or had a stroke. We'll never know. Wesley had sat waiting in the parking lot, barking until someone noticed Mom on the ground, and he stayed put until the ambulance came. Mom was revived at the hospital, but devoid of brain function. We waited until Dad arrived to disconnect the respirator. I sat there while her breath slowed, numb to all but the pain of my father. "We were a team," he said to me in the elevator on the way out, bewildered and terrified, simply unable to comprehend what had happened. Being the oldest child and only daughter, I comprehended exactly what had happened. I was now my father's guardian. When I was growing up in San Antonio, everyone seemed to know my dad, and everyone who knew him seemed to love him. He was tall and lean, with a killer smile and an old-world manner, the king of please and thank you. Well into his 80s, he still had most of his hair and a snappy goatee. The nurses did double takes when they spied the birth date on his medical chart. He came from a family that made men's clothing and married into one that sold it, so he was always a snazzy dresser. And although my father was a warm man, he was not demonstrative with his children. He graced my brothers and me with unconditional love, but he was also reserved. He had a shyness that was close to impenetrable, a border wall protecting a beautiful country no one was allowed to visit. But my father had been smitten with dogs ever since he got his first Cocker Spaniel, Jeff, as a boy. He'd tell me, "I don't trust anyone who doesn't love dogs." He wasn't kidding around. A passion for canines was a human decency barometer for Dad. He also sometimes used our pets as bodyguards and interpreters. If Dad said a dog was tired or hungry, or even angry, he might mean that he was tired or hungry or a tad pissed off, which was as mad as he ever got. The most famous example of this was when, having had too good a time at my brother Ed's wedding, Dad said he and Mom had to leave to walk the dog. A month or so after Mom passed, I rode with Dad and Wesley to meet Trilby, my father speeding and tailgating on the 5-hour drive from San Antonio to Dallas, like he was fleeing the cops. He was fleeing, of course, looking for anything that might ease the shock of my mother's passing. At the suggestion of the boarding kennel owner, a kindly woman named Dee, we left Wesley in the car while we went to meet the potential new family member. Like all of the dogs in her litter, Trilby had been, somewhat inexplicably, named after a hat. There was an indoor barn at the kennel, and Trilby sped around the perimeter, back and forth like a gazelle with stubby legs. I've often returned to that moment because it was, and still is, one of the best expressions of pure joy I've ever seen, and it was contagious in our grief. She was such a pretty dog. Trilby had a silky black, white, and brown coat and large pointed ears that rotated like furry radar detectors. She had bright eyes that telegraphed a deep interest and affection for everyone they lit on. When she walked, she threw her rear end around like a 1930s fan dancer. We loaded her up in the back next to Wesley, who greeted her with typical indifference. Trilby seemed completely baffled by his reaction. As it happened, they did not have time to get close. Wesley developed a neurological condition, much like Lou Gehrig's disease, and soon was unable to walk. Without telling anyone, Dad took him to the vet and put him down. He called me after, sobbing on the other end of the line. I wasn't sure how my father would survive this double loss. But my father was resilient. He still had his dog group, who met each morning for walks around a soccer field. And now he could show up with a cheerful, sprightly dog instead of an older, diffident one. Imagine replacing Prince Philip with Kate Middleton. Within 6 months, Dad entered the routine stage for older widowers. He started dating. These women were almost exclusively dog owners. The one who stuck was Patricia, an old friend, a widow with long, shimmering silver hair. Early in the relationship, her daughter took me aside to cautiously warn me that her mother was passionately attached to her poodle, Casey. She said, "I mean, really obsessed." "This'll work," I thought. It was Patricia who first noticed Dad's memory was beginning to fail. He would forget to make dinner reservations and get lost on familiar roads. Bookmarks in mystery novels he'd have once speedily devoured never moved. "There's something wrong with me," Dad confessed to me one night, beginning to weep. Then, in 2013, on Thanksgiving, he fell and broke his hip. Neither he nor I wanted to admit that his days of living alone in San Antonio were over, but they were. My father was 86 by then. His memory was already slipping, and leaving him alone in his apartment had become a challenge. My husband, John, who often knows me better than I know myself, noted that we were facing down one of life's toughest choices. Either I could race back and forth constantly between our home in Houston and Dad's place in San Antonio, or he could move in with us. "I like living with my wife," was the side John came down on. We could have moved Dad into an assisted living facility, but in his lucid years, my father had made it clear that doing so was something he feared more than death itself. Years back, when he was recovering from a car accident, he had called my mother at 5 a.m. from a rehab hospital, begging her to break him out. And so, in the way that many women's choices tend to come down to the needs of others, the decision wasn't ultimately mine. I knew what my husband wanted, and I knew what my father didn't want. Somehow in that calculus, our living room seemed like the best place for someone who surely did not have long to live, hip fractures being notorious killers of the aged. Most of our friends were puzzled by this decision. I tried to look on the bright side. Here was an opportunity. I could make sure the time Dad had left was spent in safety and comfort, and it would finally be a chance for us to connect on a deeper level. Unlike the rest of us, Trilby never looked back. I began to suspect that living with me had been her plan all along. In truth, I had loved that dog since the day Dad and I had driven up to get her. She had been a cheerful buffer on so many sad days and an easy subject of conversation when my father was struck with bouts of depression. I'd take Trilby for long walks, and when we'd get back, she'd vault out of the elevator, take off at a sprint, flip over and slide on her back, and then wait for a rub on her big fat belly. Sometimes I wondered if my mother's spirit hadn't made a quick turnaround, as if she was using Trilby to remind me to be happy with who I had left. If my mother's departure had been wrenchingly abrupt, Dad seemed glacial. Eventually, his memory loss was diagnosed as vascular dementia. I hired a fleet of caregivers, paid for mostly by Dad's long-term care insurance policy. I bought all kinds of walkers and made Dad take evening walks with Trilby around the block to keep up his strength. I bought socks designed to help with circulation and books. So many books. Histories and mysteries. Books about vintage cars and World War II. Collections of Sunday comics he'd read as a kid. A bound issue of the New York Times dated June 28, 1927. His birthday. Anything that might keep him reading, even though it was clear he could no longer hold a paragraph in his head. I cooked him dinner every night, and on weekdays often took him out to lunch, where he still charmed the waitresses. Of course he went with me to every one of Trilby's vet appointments. While my rational mind knew otherwise, my unconscious remained convinced that I could cure what ailed my father with nothing more than will and determination. It was hard, but not impossible. No matter how much of himself he lost, Dad always knew just how much of my life I'd put on hold to care for him, and he was grateful. His end was predictable, you could say. Dad was reaching to pet Trilby and slid off the couch and cracked his pelvis. He was 90, and didn't have the strength or inclination to put himself back together again. And within a month or so, he was gone. "I love you" were the last words he said to me just after I'd kissed him goodnight. On the way to his funeral, I got a call from Lucy, who had worked for Dad for many years. "Mimi," she said, "your daddy made me promise I would do something for him." It turned out that Dad had pulled Lucy aside some years ago and told her he wanted Wesley buried with him. So Lucy stashed his ashes in an attractive urn and had them with her. "I put him right in the crook of your dad's arm," said my friend the rabbi. Trilby stayed with us. That was a year ago. She is now somewhere around 14 and failing herself. She suffers from the same creeping, fatal paralysis that afflicted Wesley. She's gone gray, and it's been ages since I heard her shrill, piercing bark. Though she's lost the use of one leg, and the other is very weak, she still drags herself to the front door when she knows I'm leaving, begging to go with me. I bought Trilby a doggy wheelchair, a specially designed sling for her back legs, and two kinds of weird sprays that are supposed to increase paw traction on our slick wood floors. When John and I watch TV at night, I wrap her in a blanket and pull her up on my lap and rub her belly while she looks at me pensively through cloudy eyes. Then I roll her over and scratch her ears until she falls asleep, snoring slightly. I have the number of a good doggy hospice, but I'm not quite ready to let her go.
That's Mimi Swartz. This story first appeared in the April 2019 issue of Texas Monthly. You can read it at texasmonthly.com/stateofmind. Soon after this story was published, Trilby passed away. Mimi still has her two golden retrievers, but she says she also follows a lot of corgis on Instagram, so sooner or later, she may need to bring one home. If you like the show, please subscribe and visit our page at Apple Podcasts and rate the show there. State of Mind is a Texas Monthly production. Executive producer is Megan Kreit. The show is produced by Patrick Michaels and produced and engineered by Brian Standford, who also wrote the music. Our podcast intern is Harper Carlton. Graphic design is by Emily Kimbrough and Victoria Milner, featuring art by Melinda Josie. I'm your host, Katie Vine. See you next week.